Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, August 31st, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, "No Progress Leads to First Step in Superintendent Search," by Rick Davis, MISD Board President. The most important decision a school board makes is the hiring and firing of a superintendent. In light of recent events, a review of the last 3+ years is in order. In March of 2017, your MISD Board of Trustees adopted specific student outcome goals, goal progress measures, superintendent constraints, and constraint progress measures for the next 3 years to provide a continuous improvement plan to improve student outcomes. We refer to it as MISD's Lone Star Governance Plan. Later that spring, as part of our search for a new superintendent, Orlando Riddick was furnished a copy of MISD's LSG plan and informed our next superintendent would be evaluated on achievement of these 3 student outcome goals and progress measures. A few weeks after Mr. Riddick began in the summer of 2017, we received exciting news from the Texas Education Agency. The number of MISD improvement required campuses had been reduced from 9 to 4 in a single year, even though TEA's criteria to be a non-IR campus had actually been increased from the previous year. We believed such dramatic improvement in 1 year had much to do with the leadership of our then interim superintendent, Rod Schroeder. We were optimistic Mr. Riddick would improve on the significant progress the district had made. 2017-18 school year. However, following the 2017-18 school year, the district did not meet the targets for the first 2 student outcome goals regarding reading at grade level and additional reading and math standards. Nor did the district meet most of the underlying progress measures for those 2 goals. The district did meet the 3rd student outcome goal regarding increased graduation rates. But, and no reflection on him, Mr. Riddick had little or nothing to do with achieving that goal because of the 1-year lag which exists in determining graduation rates. Meanwhile, Mr. Riddick did meet all 3 superintendent constraint goals, and the district benefited from his leadership role in hiring a new chief financial officer, becoming a district of innovation, and efforts to explore in-district partnership opportunities. But the number of improvement required campuses still remained at 4, and the district's preeminent objective still remained improving student academic performance. 2018-19 school year. For the 2018-19 school year, the district did not meet the targets set for any of the 3 student outcome goals, nor did the district meet a majority of the progress measures set for any of those goals. Most disappointing was TEA determined the number of failing campuses increased from 4 to 9. The district's preeminent objective still remained improving student academic performance. Meanwhile, Mr. Riddick had a leadership role in the successful negotiation and implementation of our Texas partnership schools, and the progress made developing a school performance framework and a unified enrollment plan. 2019-20 school year. For this past school year, Governor Greg Abbott's closure of schools following spring break prevented the district from compiling the end-of-year data necessary to determine whether any of the student outcome goals or progress measures were met. However, an analysis of the data obtained during this past school year on the progress measures before COVID-19 shows the first 2 student outcome goals would not have been met, and neither would most of the progress measures for those goals. The 3rd student outcome goal was the only one which had a possibility of being met, but even that was unlikely utilizing historical data from the last 2 years. Even more troubling was a comparison of actual data from this school year as compared to last school year showed on 5 out of 8 progress measures there was either no progress, very little progress, or even worse, a regression. Goal progress measures 1.1. which measures the percentage of kindergarten through second grade students who are reading on or above grade level, showed the middle of the year percentage meeting that standard this school year was 3 percentage points less than the middle of the year percentage last year. And that number for this school year was only 2 percentage points above what it was 2 school years ago. Goal Progress Measure 1.2, which measures the percentage of kindergarten through second grade students who are reading on or above grade level, showed the middle of the year percentage meeting that standard this year school year was 4 percentage points less than the middle of the year percentage last year. And that number for this school year was 2 percentage points less than what it was 2 years ago. Goal Progress Measure 2.1, which measures the percentage of third through eighth grade students on track to meet passing standard on both reading and math, showed a 2% decrease in April this school year from May of last year. And results from the start of this school year were 5 percentage points less than the results from the start of school last year. Goal Progress Measure 2.2, which measures the percentage of economically disadvantaged third through eighth grade students on track to meet passing standard on reading and math, showed the same percentage in April of this school year as May of last year. And results from the start of this school year were the same as the start of school last year. Goal Progress Measure 2.3, which measures third through eighth grade students achieving master's level on both reading and math, only showed a 1% increase in April this school year from May of last year. Meanwhile, we had final data results on the 3 superintendent constraint goals, and that data showed none of these 3 goals were met, and only 1 of 4 of the underlying superintendent constraint progress measures were met. In short, because the district was making either no progress, little progress, or even worse, regression on a majority of the goal progress measures regarding student academic performance on which Mr. Riddick understood and agreed he would be evaluated, we made the unanimous decision to take the first step in seeking a new academic leader for our district. To those who question whether now was the time to make this decision, our response is when your chief academic leader was not successful in achieving the district's student academic goals before the challenges of COVID-19 occurred, there is no reason to believe he will be successful in the midst of it. Instead, we seek to begin the process to find the academic leader who can lead this district to meet this community's expectations for improving academic performance. We welcome your prayers and support in achieving that goal. This article is entitled Oil: Pandemic Accelerates Energy Industry's Digital Transformation, by Sergio Chapa, Houston Chronicle. On a late afternoon in April, Nabil Lamia, an engineer working from home because of the coronavirus, walked onto a balcony in Paris, wearing jeans, a t-shirt, and a hard hat equipped with a video camera, microphone, and earpiece. In another part of Paris, his boss, Eric Duquesne, senior vice president at the French oil major Total, watched images of the Paris skyline on his computer and interacted with Lamia through the video conferencing platform Microsoft Teams. Duquesne was so impressed that 3 days later, the smart helmets arrived at Total's petrochemical plant in La Porte, where workers could transmit video to Paris and solve problems that once required flying-in engineers. Total is distributing the helmets, developed by the Washington State tech firm RealWear, across its operation from North America to Europe to Asia to Africa. It is not a solution for just the lockdown period, Duquesne said. It's definitely an enabler to improve performance and speed. It's all about being faster. The coronavirus pandemic and the oil crash it spurred are accelerating a digital transformation that was already underway as oil and gas companies drove to boost efficiency, cut costs, and make money at lower commodity prices. Now, with restrictions on travel and social interaction, tools such as drones, cloud computing, artificial intelligence, 5G-enabled sensors, and fiber optic networks are allowing energy companies to run field operations from offices in Houston, Paris, or London, instead of putting boots on the ground. The technologies are not only helping companies adapt to the pandemic, but also to become more efficient over the long term as they face an extended period of low oil prices. As with the oil bust that ran roughly from 2014 to 2016, many of the 100,000 jobs lost in this year's crude price collapse are unlikely to ever return. The Houston area had recovered only about one-third of the 10 of thousands of jobs lost in the previous bust before the coronavirus hit. Analysts say employment will permanently shrink again when the industry emerges from this downturn as technology does more of the work. With automation and the rise of digital, you're not going to need as many people as you needed in the past to run a rig, said Rachel Eberhard, an oil industry expert with the Houston office of the consulting firm Ernst & Young. You're going to be doing things differently and doing business differently. Remote operations are going to become the new normal. The types of jobs and skills also will change as technicians and software developers replace roughnecks and roustabouts. In oil field services, the hardest hit by financial losses, developing new equipment and digital tools is viewed as vital to the survival of the sector and broader oil and gas industry. Shifting energy consumption, forecasts of lower forever oil prices, and the urgency of climate change are forcing the industry to adopt more efficient and cleaner practices that lower greenhouse gas emissions. The oilfield services sector is where a lot of the technology for the entire industry comes from, said Leslie Beyer, president of the Petroleum Equipment and Services Association, a trade group in Houston. The digitalization piece is no different. We drive a lot of innovation. Houston oilfield service company Baker Hughes embraced high-tech tools such as smart helmets, 3D printing to make parts on demand, drones to detect leaks, and artificial intelligence identify patterns in oil field data before the pandemic. But interest in the company's remote drilling capabilities has grown rapidly since the outbreak of the deadly virus. Paul Madero, the company's vice president of global drilling services, said Baker Hughes rolled out its earliest versions of remote drilling for offshore customers in the North Sea more than 20 years ago. The technology, he said, took time to gain wider acceptance because most customers preferred only to have a physical presence on site. Onshore interest started to grow faster 1 to 2 years ago as technological advances drove down costs and improved well performance at a time when many shale producers were struggling to remain profitable. Interest in the technology, he said, accelerated after COVID because social distancing measures that limited travel to and from the rigs. There are wells that were drilled and completed only because we had this technology. That's a fact, Madero said. With borders locked down and the COVID exposure that was taking place, we were able to drill and complete those wells because we had this remote capability. It's a tremendous enabler. Baker Hughes typically kept 4 employees at drilling sites that used the company's equipment and software. But that may become less common after COVID. Using remote technologies, employees that otherwise would have been deployed to the field can monitor and control drilling equipment from another location. In addition to saving on travel time and costs, Madero said, remote drilling also allows engineers to consult with other experts not on site. Remote drilling was used at 50% of the company's sites last year. That number rose to 60% in the first quarter and grew to 72% in the second quarter. We see this as a complete structural acceleration that's not temporary. This is long-term and permanent, Madera said. What you're seeing is that these capabilities that existed and the business-as-usual infrastructure has been completely changed. This is a real step change. Baker Hughes' common competitors, Halliburton and Technip FMC, entered a joint venture in July to provide lightning-fast fiber-optic technology to oil and gas wells on the seafloor. Their Odyssey equipment uses fiber-optic cables that double as acoustic sensors to improve the speed and quality of data received from underwater wells, allowing engineers at the surface to improve a well's productivity. Davis Larson, CEO of the Scottish oilfield company ProServe Controls, said the downturn has offshore producers seeking to expand or improve efficiency at existing wells rather than drill new ones. Given the high cost of exploring offshore oil and gas fields, Larson said, it is cheaper and less risky to add wells to proven oil fields while upgrading equipment on offshore platforms, automating operations, and collecting and analyzing data to boost productivity. These are challenging times, no doubt, Larson said, but equally they offer firms an opportunity to evolve and readjust some of their core activities and ways of doing things. Companies also are increasing investments in cloud computing and artificial intelligence, platforms that store and analyze massive amounts of data to discern and reveal patterns that engineers can use to improve the productivity of a well. Baker Hughes, Microsoft, and the Silicon Valley tech firm C3.ai are entered into a three-way deal in November to increase oil field adoption of artificial intelligence, while Halliburton, the consulting firm Accenture, and Microsoft entered into a five-year deal in July to expand Halliburton's remote drilling and hydraulic fracturing operations using the Microsoft Azure cloud computing program. Houston oilfield services company Ambient uses artificial intelligence to automate tasks such as deciding how many strokes pumps should make to pull crude to the surface. The company's technology can adjust the well's production up or down remotely, reducing man hours and travel to isolated sites. People are asking themselves, how can I do more with less? Ambient CEO Blake McLean said. They're asking themselves, how can we get more hydrocarbons out of our existing wells at a lower cost? The Norwegian company Cognite, which develops software to improve the efficiency of oil wells and offshore wind projects, has expanded its Houston and Austin offices, hiring more than a dozen people at a time when tens of thousands of oil and gas workers have lost jobs. The company's North American president, Francois Labarie, said that growth demonstrates the greater role that technology will play in the industry after the pandemic. By adopting new technology and new tools, what people call digitalization, that's something that benefits from a crisis like the one we're going through, Labarie said. You have to become more efficient. You have to allow people to operate from wherever they're at, because you can't fly people around like you used to. This article is entitled Commentary. Mass Shooting Was Just Beginning of Community's Pain, by Stuart Doreen. The sound of police and emergency vehicle sirens was like nothing I had ever heard before. You didn't need social media or texts or to go to MRT.com to know that something was wrong. All you needed to do was walk out the front door. It was eerie, surreal, random, scary, and concerning, because those sirens indicated that all was not well. They represent danger, tragedy, and likely death. As it turned out, the sirens that filled the air on August 31st, 2019, sent an alert that there was more bad news to come. I still remember driving back from Odessa that day, long after the shooting had stopped, after the ambulances had delivered the injured to the hospitals, after the final press conferences of the day, and just as our communities collectively realized that we had joined the list of other metropolitan areas where mass shootings weren't someone else's problems. The sound of the sirens from earlier in that day were still through my head. I remember the Synergy Theaters on Business 20 was a ghost town. I remember the streets were not what they usually were on a Saturday night in Midland. It was a premonition of things to come. I appreciate those who have volunteered their time to write about their thoughts on that day and what's ahead for our two cities. My view today will be different, because as coincidental as it might be, the mass shootings event of August 31st, 2019 was the worst, but still seems the first of a series of events that inflicted real pain in our community. It has been 12 months, and what a year it has been. Death, community division, economic destabilization, a once-in-a-century pandemic, an educational crisis, electoral chaos, and cries for racial justice. Midlanders became well-versed in the school bond election, an ensuing drama created by a missing ballot box, Midlanders know all about the price of oil that on August 31st, 2019 was trading at $55.10 and was destined to fall off a cliff into negative territory. On that day, the rig count in the Permian was at 429. On Friday, it was 125. Midland County residents have had enough of coronavirus and its impact on healthcare, the economy, and education. And as we mourn the loss, let us not forget that the number of Midland County coronavirus-related deaths is 67 and counting. But these 12 months have been remarkable in what they have done to the psyche of a community. I'd like to flash a hashtag about how strong these communities have been after a series of haymakers landed, one after another. But slogans aside, when we pull back the covers, we are not better. We are different. These 12 months have been an exercise in dividing a community. Those who are for a certain bond proposal and those who are against, those who are for wearing masks and those who are against, those who are for the renaming of a school and those against, those who believe racial inequality plays a much greater factor and those who don't, and those who believe it is time for a school district to cut loose its superintendent and those who don't. These 12 months have been the ultimate stress test. How well can law enforcement react to a mass shooting that was unprecedented as the shooter was on the move? How well is your election system working? How well is your community able to absorb the worst downturn in terms of the price of oil? How well is your hospital able to improvise when the invisible enemy plagues a county? And how well can your education system handle the closing of campuses and still meet the needs of all its students? But the ultimate test over these 12 months has been to a community support system that is overloaded. Mental health needs have been obvious from the first time the first siren could be heard on that tragic day. We know our community is dealing with real needs when it comes to children's well-being, the strength of the family unit, educational support, substance abuse, the desire for racial issues to be addressed, and the impact for an economic downturn on a community. It is not insignificant that there are great pressures to get food on the family's dinner table, to pay next month's rent, and to keep students at a level consistent with their grade. We worry about this last one because of the long-term ramifications. While the economy should come back and schools will reopen, education is facing the very real possibility of having a large portion of its student population in a position of not being able to catch up, at least not under current conditions, for years, if at all. There is so much more to cover. I haven't even talked about how the past 12 months impacted our faith, law and order, community optimism, which might be as low as I remember in my 25 years in Midland, how people in our community talk with each other, and the noticeable gaps created when it comes to social growth and technological dependence. For many, today was supposed to provide an opportunity to look back at one of the worst moments in the history of Midland-Odessa. But I want to thank you for allowing me to go off script, because amid the sirens and shootings on that day 1 year ago, a community's pain was just beginning. This article is entitled "Inn of the Mountain Gods Reopens with Safety Measures in Place" by Rosanna M. Martinez, Albuquerque Journal. Inn of the Mountain Gods Resort and Casino will welcome back guests beginning today. The Mescalero Apache tribe decided to reopen the property with enhanced safety measures in place. Sovereignty allows tribes to make necessary decisions to protect their citizens as they know best what their people need, Frizzell Frizzell Jr., Chief Operating Officer at Inn of the Mountain Gods, said in a news release issued by the casino. Our tribal leadership has worked tirelessly to ensure that every decision is made with the needs of the Mescalero Apache tribe in mind, while also following the guidance of leading health and government officials and recommendations by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Inn of the Mountain Gods, located in Mescalero, near Ruidoso, will open its casino floor from 8 a.m. to 4 a.m. daily, and will close for deep cleaning from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. Table games, with the exception of poker, will be open from 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. Sunday through Thursday, and from 10 a.m. to 4 a.m. Friday through Saturday, starting Tuesday, according to the release. The sports book at the inn will be open from noon to 8 p.m. Thursday through Monday, with kiosk sports betting available during operating hours. The Little Arbor Snack Bar features an extended menu and will offer carryout only from 11 a.m. to 2 a.m. Sunday through Thursday, and 11 a.m. to 4 a.m. Friday through Saturday. The Stronghold Gift Shop will be open from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Sunday through Thursday, and 7 a.m. to midnight Friday through Saturday, according to the release. A designated patio area next to the casino will be available for outdoor dining. The hotel, spa at the inn, Topgolf Swing Suite, Wendell's Steak and Seafood, Broken Arrow Tap House, Apache Tea, and the Gathering of Nations Buffet will remain closed until further notice. Information and restrictions can be found at innofthemountaingods.com. Its sister location, the Casino Apache Travel Center, reopened on August 24th. Its casino floor is open from 8 a.m. to 4 a.m. daily and will close from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. for deep cleaning. The convenience store will open from 8 a.m. to midnight 7 days a week. Smoky Bees will be open for food carryout from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day. The Round Bar remains closed, according to a Casino Apache news release. For more information and updates on Casino Apache, call 800-545-9011 or visit CasinoApacheTravelCenter.com. Outdoor recreational activities and amenities, including boating, fishing, golf, and zip lining, will operate by advance reservation only, with limits to parties of the same group, according to the Inn of the Mountain Gods news release. The Inn of the Mountain Gods Championship Golf Course will open Wednesday through Sunday. Zip lining and boating will be available Friday through Sunday. Enhanced safety measures are in place, including physical distancing, rigorous cleaning, and sanitization guidelines, as well as mandatory face covering protocols, according to the news release. Smoking is prohibited indoors. Temperature checks will be done upon entry to protect the health and safety of patrons and team members. The health and safety of our guests and team members has always been and remains our highest priority, Frizzell Jr. says in the release. Throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, tribal nations have set an example for sound, future-oriented policy as sovereign nations. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, August 31st. Odessa strong, 1 year later. Life changed in an instant. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. For the Davis family, life truly changed in an instant the afternoon of August 31st when a lone mobile gunman killed 7 and injured 25. Kelby and Garrett Davis and their now 2-year-old twins, Anderson and Rhett, were in the car going to Market Street to pick up some food for a friend's barbecue at about 4:15 p.m. Quote, "We were leaving our house on Saturday to go to Market Street, and so we were parked right there at the red light at 42nd Street, facing west, to turn left onto Parkway to go to Market Street. And while we were just sitting there, one bullet went through the rear driver's side of our car and went through our back seat. At the time, the twins were rear-facing because they were under 2, so it went through our car, through the middle seat, and then kind of broke up into shrapnel and hit Anderson in the chest and mouth," Kelby Davis said. "It was hard to get through to 911 because of the chaos going on at the time. The gunman, Seth Ator, had opened fire in Midland and Odessa from 2 different vehicles. He was ultimately killed by law enforcement. There were fire trucks and paramedics driving around." Kelby added that Garrett comes from a firefighting family and his father is retired from Odessa Fire Rescue. Quote, "We recognized some of the firemen and paramedics who came over and helped us that day. Brad Reese and Kellen Foreman were off-duty firefighters who happened to be at a nearby restaurant, and they thankfully came to our car and started checking on Anderson, making sure she was okay. We were able to flag down an ambulance that already had another victim in it, but it was an adult. So because she was a child, they were able to put her on the ambulance with that adult, Kelby Davis said. Anderson was taken to Medical Center Hospital, and after she was checked out, she was stable enough to transfer to University Medical Center in Lubbock by helicopter. Quote, that is where she had her first surgeries, with shrapnel being removed from her chest and her mouth and tongue, with the holes in her tongue and lip being sewn up. Then we came home, and a couple of weeks later she was able to have surgery to have her teeth removed because the bullet knocked out three of her teeth, Kelby Davis said. Kelby said she calmed Anderson down by singing Jesus Loves Me to her in the back of the ambulance. She sang so loud that Foreman asked her to be quiet because he was trying to make a call related to the emergency. She added that she told Anderson angels would fly with her to Lubbock, quote, and they did, unquote. Garrett Davis, who was a clinic manager for First Physicians, said another amazing thing. One of the providers in Lubbock who took Anderson in when she arrived FaceTimed the parents. Quote, she was able to see us, Garrett Davis said. Obviously, that didn't calm her down a whole lot. She was screaming bloody murder, but I thought it was awesome that someone would take the time to realize the gravity of the situation, that her parents couldn't be with her, and took that extra step. End quote. Kelby Davis added that she could not say enough about the first responders. Quote, there were many on duty that day who were trying to figure out what was going on and were literally saving lives and doing what they could. Then there were so many off duty, and the two men, Brad and Kellen, who came to our aid were just enjoying a meal at a restaurant and chose to run into the sound of gunshots and help, she said. There were also people at Medical Center Hospital, from the Ector County Sheriff's Office and police, armed to escort everyone coming into the hospital. Davis said they also were escorted out to the helicopter. She said a police officer, whose name she didn't know, told the Davises that they needed to breathe and drive safely to Lubbock to be with Anderson. The officer told the couple that if they didn't make it, they weren't going to be any good for their daughter. The nurses and the air flight nurse were all kind to them. Quote, as a mother, it brought me reassurance that they would take care of my baby until I got there. One thing that was really neat was a respiratory therapist named Gayla. She works at Medical Center, and she was actually the baby's respiratory therapist when they were in the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit. She was working in the ER that day, and she recognized Anderson and kept telling everyone that this was one of their NICU babies. So just to see that familiar face and for her to recognize us was so meaningful, Kelby Davis said. Quote, I could go on and on about the care we received at Medical Center, and even though I am very passionate, especially since then, about pediatric care in our community, and how we need to continue to strengthen pediatric care. I still believe they did everything they could that day to help us safely arrive in Lubbock to get the more advanced critical pediatric care that Anderson needed that day, she added. Garrett Davis said the first couple of months after the shooting were rough. Quote, she was not acting like her normal self and just going through the surgeries and recoveries and all that kind of stuff. The first few months probably were the toughest, he said. God was what got them through that first and foremost. Quote, we believe that evil was in Odessa that day, and God did not have any of that happen, he said. Quote, God has walked beside us for every single second since then. Then I strongly believe he has placed so many people in our lives from that moment until now. But definitely, other than him, what got us through it was our community. We are very passionate about Odessa. We love Odessa. We love our community. We chose to live here. We were born and raised here, went to college here, have never left here. Kelby Davis said the community has supported them through their trials and still reaches out and checks on them to see how they're doing. Quote, people who didn't even know us, people whose job was to take care of us, community leaders, family, friends, and church people, all came together to support us, she said. The Davises attend the bridge, where Kelby Davis is the assistant pastor. James Santana, an Odessa police officer who was shot August 31st, also attends the church. Quote, so we had a shared experience, and we were so thankful for his service in protecting us that day, Kelby Davis said. She added that the pastor, Donnie Williams, and the congregation as a whole were a great support. She added that Williams was at the emergency room and medical center, drove to Lubbock, and conducted church services the next day. Quote, they've all been amazing, Kelby Davis said. It's been continued support for sure, not just that day or the few days after or the few weeks, end quote. Kelby Davis said the family is doing well. Quote, I think it's changed us for the better. Any tragedy makes you appreciate life more and makes you realize what a supportive community you have. But I think in other ways it takes something from you. It takes a little bit of innocence from you and a carefreeness, Kelby Davis said. Quote, sitting at a red light on a Saturday afternoon, no worries in the world that your babies would be safe in their car seats in the back. I think we're doing very well and are just thankful and grateful to be where we are today, end quote. She added that Anderson's story spread worldwide. Her brother was deployed in Afghanistan at the time, and they were talking about Anderson. He realized it was his niece. Quote, knowing that all around the world people are praying and sending us well wishes is something we're definitely going to carry on to these two children, making sure they always know how to make people feel loved like people made us feel, Kelby Davis said. As for how Anderson and Rhett are faring now, Kelby Davis said, they are doing great. Quote, they are the busiest two-year-olds. As you can see, we snack all the time, and it's been weird, obviously, with COVID. They've been out of school, but it's been nice, too, because we've gotten extra time with them. I feel like they've crossed so many milestones since turning two, getting big kid beds and potty trained. They're like little kids now and not babies, so they're doing great, she said. Kelby said she and Garrett underwent counseling immediately. Quote, everyone I reached out to said Anderson was too young to remember or anything like that. I'm also thankful for that and that we have those resources in the Midland Odessa community. I believe it's something people should talk about more and normalize more, she said. Asked whether the shooting changed her views regarding guns, Kelby Davis said she didn't want to comment. Quote, everyone's situation was so different that day, so I know there are some people it has changed. I know some people are more passionately swayed one way or the other. We never saw him. We never saw the car. One bullet did that much damage, and it was all gone and passed before we could have done anything or seen anything, so I don't think it's changed anything we believe, Kelby Davis said. A memorial marking the shooting is planned for Memorial Gardens Park. Davis said she has been in some of the emails about selecting artists and has offered her thoughts. Quote, I'm just once again thankful. I think it's amazing that our community wants to honor everyone who was affected that day and to bring a symbol of hope and remembrance, especially for those who lost their lives and for their families to leave a little bit of their legacy is beautiful. I'm very thankful that Odessa and Odessa Arts are coming together to put that together for our community, she said. I really do hope it honors and leaves some of the legacy for those who lost their lives, and it can always be a way they will be remembered, Kelby Davis said. What she wants people to learn from that tragic day is that there is always hope, and that it's important to come together. Quote, "For me, I just hope that people don't remember necessarily the evil. I hope it's love and hope and community, because that cannot be taken away from us. I think that was strengthened," Gelby Davis said. Garrett Davis said what he's taken away is that life is too short. Quote, "And just when you think everything's going right in the world, something can happen that completely disrupts your life. But I think it's important that everybody knows life is going to happen and things are going to happen. But like Kelby said, if we come together as a community, hope is not lost. And just because things may not go your way or bad things are going to happen, life will still go on, and we can come together and be strong as a community," Garrett Davis said. Kelby Davis added that they know they can never thank everyone for the support they've received. Quote, "It's impossible because most of these people we don't know, but I just hope that every chance we get through the rest of our lives, we'll be able to say thank you. Thank you for loving us. Thank you for praying for us. Thank you for being our community when we needed you, and we promise that our babies will always grow up knowing the importance of passing that forward and doing that for other people. And all those people will always be a part of their story," she said. Committee selects Sanborn to create memorial. Sculptor has long-standing connection with West Texas. The story was written by Sam Waller. Maryland sculptor Jim Sanborn has been commissioned to create Odessa's memorial to commemorate the victims of last year's mass shooting. The August 31st Memorial Committee selected Sanborn's design, Bright Stars, a Memorial, from a field of three finalists. Sanborn, whose works include the encrypted Cryptos sculpture at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, was one of 138 artists who applied for the commission via publicartist.org. Quote, "I really hope dearly the piece works the way I hope it will work and will memorialize all the people involved in a sensitive way," Sanborn said. 7 people were killed and another 25 injured during a mass shooting spree by gunman Seth Ator. Ator was killed after his hour-long rampage in a shootout with area law enforcement agents in a field near Odessa's Synergy Theater. Randy Hamm, executive director of Odessa Arts, said Sanborn's reputation and track record of creating thought-provoking public works made him an easy choice for the selection committee. Quote, "Not only that, but of the finalists, he was the one that we felt did the best job of speaking to our community and making this memorial personal," Hamm said. "The design and the ability for the community members to be able to see clear text on this was very important. It's just a stunning design that I think matches the gravity of the situation," end quote. Sanborn said he was drawn to the project in part because of his long-standing connection with West Texas, as well as his involvement in other memorial projects. Quote, "First of all, I love West Texas," Sanborn said. "I spent a good bit of time down around Big Bend and Marfa and all that. A few years ago, I did a project for a veterans home in which I did a memorial for an airman who had received the Medal of Honor for his bravery in an airplane over Vietnam. I felt a great deal of satisfaction from that, so I chose to do this, partly because I felt as if I might be able to make a contemplative space where people could remember this, reflect on it, and make space they could enjoy as much as anyone could enjoy this kind of thing," end quote. Hamm said Sanborn's design was just what the selection committee had in mind. An 11-foot bronze cylinder measuring 5 feet in diameter will have a cut-out text honoring the victims and first responders from the shooting, which at night will be illuminated from inside the cylinder. Quote, "It's just not a name," Hamm said. we are reminded that it is someone's brother, that's someone's sister, that's someone's neighbor. It allows us to think of them not as statistics, but as people and community members. Sanborn has produced similar works now displayed in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Fort Myers, Florida, Rochester, New York, Houston, and Denver. Quote, "The central element, this projection cylinder that has a pinpoint light that projects letters everywhere around the site, is something I've been doing for about 25 years, he said. I've done many of these around the U.S. That part of the memorial is something I'm pretty familiar with. Quote, "The text on that cylinder is unique to each site and will be unique to this site. The area around it is different from other ones. I often do get the opportunity to work with the landscape around one of my projection cylinders. I actually prefer it. It enables the cylinder to project the text over a wide area, and it's very clear. It's also circular in this case, which lends itself to the circular nature of the cylinder." End quote. To create space for the design at Memorial Garden, Odessa Arts and the City of Odessa's Park and Recreation Department are working to redesign portions of the East Plaza section to include seating areas and the ability to offer space for public gatherings. The total cost of the project is estimated to be $800,000 and will be funded by a combination of hotel occupancy tax money and private donations. Work is expected to take a year, and Ham hopes to unveil the art on the second anniversary observance on August 31, 2021. To learn more about the project, visit odessaarts.org. More of Sanborn's work can be seen at jimsanborn.net. Don't forget the victims. Here's a list of those who died, along with quotes from people who knew them. 15-year-old Odessa High School sophomore Lila Hernandez, quote, "She always walked in with a smile on her face, and all of her teammates loved her," end quote. Teacher Joe Griffith, age 40, quote, "He made us smile. He was passionate about his students and loved us, and we knew it," end quote. Postal carrier Mary Granados, age 29, quote, "So very kind and so sweet and very honest and responsible and helpful when needed. She was loving," end quote. Odessan Edwin Peregrino, age 25, quote, "Every room he walked in, he always had that room lit up with a smile and laugh. He made a difference in every soul he met. He made a mark," end quote. Rodolfo Julio Arco, age 57, quote, "We reached the American dream," end quote. Former soldier Cameron Cartless Brown, age 30, of Brownwood, quote, "He was our laughter, always the life of our family. He always made sure everybody was happy. That's the kind of guy he was," end quote. Truck driver Raul Garcia, age 35, of El Paso, quote, "He had a big heart and was always reaching out and helping others," end quote. And now a list of the injured. Nathan Hernandez, age 18, from Odessa. Mark Gonzalez, age 38, from Odessa. Zachary Owens, Midland Police Department. Timothy Beard, age 55, of San Antonio. James Santana, Odessa Police Department. Glenda Dempsey, age 62, from Odessa. Marco Corral, age 62, from San Diego, California. Coy Edge, age 53, from Odessa. Joseph Glide, age 60, from Odessa. Anderson Davis, 17 months, from Odessa. Daniel Munoz, age 28, from Yuma, Arizona. Robert Cavazos, age 38, from Alice, Texas. Maria Baudo, age 27, from Hialeah, Florida. Efe Oba-Yagbana, age 45, from Round Rock, Texas. Bradley Grimsley, age 64, from Oklahoma. Chuck Pryor from the Texas Department of Public Safety, Timothy Hardaway, age 54, from Brownwood, Quadri Fatai, age 41, from Houston, Jesus Alvarez, age 21, from Gardendale, Lilia Diaz, age 46, from Odessa, Crystal Lee, 36, from Odessa, Larry Shores, age 34, from Abilene, Colton Rienga, age 9, from Odessa, Penny Moore, age 55, from Andrews, Wanda Silvas, age 74, from Odessa.
This is Trish reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, September 1st, 2020. Memorial Gardens Park will get makeover for Memorial by J.C. Lewis, jc.lewis, at hearstnp.com. Memorial Gardens Park will serve as a focal point in memorializing the events of August 31st, 2019. The park will receive a makeover to create room for the August 31st memorial, which was approved by the Odessa City Council on August 25th. Shortly after the mass shooting, Odessa Mayor David Turner approached Randy Hamm, Executive Director of Odessa Arts, about funding a piece of art to commemorate the event and have a place for people to grieve, mourn, and heal. Hamm talked to the public, art committee, and members decided to put together a selection committee made up of community stakeholders, members of the public art committees, victims' families, and victims. 25 people were selected. The director of Parks and Recreation, Steve Patton, who is also on the Public Arts Committee, suggested that the memorial be placed at Memorial Gardens Park. The park serves as a place for people to gather in memory of 9/11, and numerous fundraising walks are held there. However, a lot of art is already placed at the entrance of the park. In order for this to stand out and be accessible to the public, we're going to have to make room for it, Hamm said. Steve and I talked to KDC Associates, who is the original landscape architect for this park, and came up with some ways to rehome the art that is out there and create a plaza that will house the memorial art and will serve as a place together. Over 138 artists applied for the memorial project, and three artists were selected as finalists. Hamm said there was one submission that stood apart from every other artist's concept. Jim Sanborn of Washington, D.C. was selected for the project. I think this particular design really speaks to what the community needs. The piece is called Bright Stars, a Memorial. Installation consists of an 11-inch bronze cylinder with cutout text honoring the victims and first responders from August 31st. The text is visible during the day, and at night the text is illuminated and cast to the ground with the assistance of a bright light in the center of the cylinder. The project is estimated to cost $800,000 and will be funded by a combination of hotel occupancy tax money and private donations. Hamm said he is hoping the art piece will be finished by the second anniversary, August 31st, 2021. It is going to be a beautiful way for art to help the community heal. I'm going to make a one note to this article. There's a rendering of the memorial, which is it does not look like an 11-inch bronze cylinder. It looks like 11 feet is the circumference, so it's about 5.5 feet across. MISD Board Puts Riddick on Administrative Leave by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at hearstnp.com. The Midland ISD Board has put Superintendent Orlando Riddick on administrative leave and named Chief Financial Officer Daryl Dodds as the acting superintendent. Both decisions came during a special meeting held Monday. It was the third special meeting related to the district superintendent position since the August 17th regular board meeting, when trustees were expected to perform an evaluation on Riddick, who had completed his third year with MISD. However, that meeting ended with the superintendent's contract not being extended and a special meeting set for August 21st. During that meeting, it was decided to begin termination proceedings on August 25th. At that meeting, the board unanimously voted on the termination of Riddick's contract, which continues until June 2022. The most recent vote by board before Monday set in place a termination process that could last 3.5 months. Now that we have provided Superintendent Riddick with notice of intent to terminate his contract, there's a process which takes place whenever that happens, Board President Rick Davis said at the meeting Monday night. There are options available to Mr. Riddick to contest that action or not contest the action, because that's going to be his focus. Obviously, we don't believe it's either in his best interest or nor the district's best interest for him to continue his duties as superintendent. So the motion has been made to place him on administrative leave, so that process will play out. Davis said an acting superintendent refers to someone who is already existing on the staff, an MISD employee who, in addition to regular duties, assumes duties of acting superintendent. Meanwhile, an interim superintendent is a non-existing staff person, a third party that you ask to come in and act as superintendent until such time as you find your replacement superintendent. Davis said the current dynamics, especially with COVID-19, make this an especially challenging time, and the academic directors and other political candidates for the acting superintendent position will continue to be focused on their academic responsibilities for the district. Dodds was selected to be acting superintendent, according to Davis, because we believe that in our search for an interim superintendent, the most pressing needs we have for the acting superintendent is to sign contracts, review other financial matters that require attention that Mr. Dodds is already giving to those things. So we think it makes sense for him to assume this role as an acting superintendent until such time as we find an interim superintendent, while everyone else can remain completely focused on their existing job responsibilities, particularly on the academic front. The Midland ISD board passed both items unanimously. The potential naming of an acting superintendent sets up the district to move forward in finding an interim superintendent, the second in 4 years. In 2016, the board selected former Amarillo ISD Superintendent Rod Schroeder to be the interim superintendent after Ryder Warren left MISD for a district in the Metroplex. Davis referenced Schroeder's time in a leadership position with the district in an opinion article in Monday's Reporter Telegram. A few weeks after Mr. Riddick began in the summer of 2017, we received exciting news from the TEA. The number of MISD improvement required campuses had been reduced from 9 to 4 in a single school year, even though the TEA's criteria to be a non-IR campus had actually been increased from the previous year. We believed such dramatic improvement in 1 year had much to do with the leadership of our then interim superintendent, Rod Schroeder. Gun control. Cornyn, unlicensed gun dealers need to be eliminated, by J.C. Lewis. Odessa. U.S. Senator John Cornyn visited Odessa on Monday, the one-year anniversary of the mass shooting in which 7 people were killed and 25 were injured. He toured New Tech Odessa and talked about school district funding from the CARES Act, and also talked to the press about gun purchase background checks. When talking about the situation that allowed the Odessa mass shooter Seth Ator to purchase a firearm, Cornyn said unlicensed firearm dealers need to be eliminated. We need to make sure that we eliminate unlicensed firearm dealers, which will mean more people get background checks, because all FFLs, federal firearms licenses, are required to do those. This, I think, draws the appropriate line between law-abiding citizens exercising their Second Amendment rights, which I enthusiastically support, and the line between legitimate and illegitimate use by people who are convicted criminals or people with documented mental illness. The Odessa shooter allegedly purchased the weapon used on August 31st, 2019, from an unlicensed seller. Law enforcement authorities picked up 29 more weapons from his premises, demonstrating he was not just some amateur or hobbyist. He was in the business of making and selling firearms. The senator said he wouldn't be surprised if the seller is convicted on federal charges after the investigation concludes. He said he's a supporter of the Second Amendment, but also supports background checks on gun purchases, especially after the Sutherland Springs Church mass shooting that occurred in November of 2017. I'm a supporter of background checks, which will identify people who are legally disqualified from purchasing firearms. Cornyn offered his support to parents and people affected by these shootings. Just like El Paso and Sutherland Springs, each of these tragedies we have seen, the best comfort I can think to offer parents and people who are affected is something good will come out of it. If we can do something good, like making sure we eliminate these unlicensed firearms dealers who bypass the background check system, then we will save lives.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.